Welcome to a new episode of the Forgiveness Lab podcast. The Forgiveness Lab, we believe that forgiveness is not just something that God does, but is a deep outpouring of who God is in every aspect of our lives. That we are gifted repeatedly in ways that are meant to liberate us and empower us to love as we've been loved. I'm your host, Scott Hutchinson, and this morning I'm delighted to welcome Shane Claiborne. I would describe Shane as a rather remarkable evangelist who brings an incarnational gospel message, inviting us deeply into the journey of discipleship and the experience of beloved community. Shane travels widely, but lives with great intention locally. Shane is the author of a number of books, including The Irresistible Revolution, which has emerged as something of a contemporary classic. His newest book with Michael Martin is Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. Shane is a founder of Red Letter Christians, a movement of folks committed to living as if Jesus meant the things he said. He has long been committed to advocating for the homeless and being in solidarity with homeless folk, to interfering with war by embodying peace, and to ending the death penalty and transforming gun violence. I'm sure the bio could go on longer, Shane, but we'll just talk now. So welcome to the Forgiveness Lab.
Yeah, good to be with you, man. I love talking about forgiveness.
Good, good. Well, I just want to give you a chance to talk with me and us about what you're up to. The other day I was revisiting Mary Oliver's poem, The Invitation. And in it, she writes, "It's a serious thing just to be alive on this fresh morning in a broken world." So I want to invite you to tell us how you're engaging the marvel of your life these days.
Well, I'm looking across the street and there's a line of dozens and dozens of folks that are being cared for and getting food, and we've got gardens that are blooming, and I got a mural with the sun smiling on it across the street, and we've got this little community that we've been trying to build for the last 20 years at the Simple Way, and we say that we're trying to build a neighborhood that we're proud to call home, and that, you know, is kind of comprehensive in how we think about that, making abandoned houses homes, turning them into homes, and planting community gardens. And part of what we're doing nowadays too is Katie and I are both apprenticing blacksmiths, you know, so we take guns and turn them into garden tools, and I love it. That's holy work too, so it's all real connected. So I'm writing a book right now, so on the a consistent ethic of life, how every person's made in the image of God. And I'm trying to be pro-life from womb to tomb and interrupt everything that's crushing people's dignity and life. And so right now that looks like beating guns into garden tools. It looks like working hard to try to create alternatives to the death penalty and to stand against, you know, militarism and war. And yeah, so we're doing what we can, brother. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. When you were talking about a consistent life ethic, I was thinking about Ron Sider's work and writing.
Yeah, I got it right here beside me. I got I've got about 20 books beside me here, but I'm pulling on the wisdom of the ages as I create this. And one of those is just the writings of the early Christians, you know, who were so consistent in their own denunciation of violence and death and kind of every manifestation it had, from military combat to the gladiatorial games, you know. So I aspire to be consistent like that.
those are good aspirations. There's a sound of joy in your voice as you talk about all of that.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. I like that old song, this joy that I have, the world didn't give it to me and the world can't take it away. You ever heard that one?
I like it. I'm tempted to invite you to sing it, but.
Yeah. All right. This joy that I have, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it and the world can't take it away.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. A hymn for the morning, this morning, in our beautiful and fractured world.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll tell you what, let's dive in talking about forgiveness. Let me offer you an invitation. If you're willing, can you tell me something or tell us something about your experiences of being forgiven?
Wow. Well, there's a lot of places that I see the power of forgiveness, and, you know, I've experienced it in my own life. The most poignant, I think, are some of the stories that I've seen had the opportunity to be in relationship with folks that have survived a lot of violence. One of them, actually, I'm talking to tomorrow night, Charlotta Evans, who has been in the forefront of restorative justice. But, you know, there's so many of these stories. I think of one of the folks that I'm with a lot these days is Sharon Risher, who her mother was killed in Emmanuel AME Church by Dylan Roof. Her whole family, her two cousins, her family friends were killed there as they, you know, did their Wednesday night prayer meeting in the historic Emmanuel Church. And we've had the opportunity to process that. I've been walking with her. She's been walking with me, kind of teaching me about the power of forgiveness over and over, you know. And one of the things that I've heard her say many times is to kind of debunk the idea that you forgive and forget. You know, we kind of hear that cliche a lot. And she says, no, you forgive and you remember because the scars are always there. Your loved one's not coming back. And that actually reminds us of the power of forgiveness and in the face of really tremendous evil that we're capable of. And, you know, Dylan Roof, the person who was responsible for that massacre, is pretty much unrepentant, you know, as far as I know. And yet Sharon Richards taught me, you know, that you forgive not so that Dylan Roof can sleep at night, but so that you can sleep at night, you know, and it really begins to heal and really free you from the hatred and the bondage of wanting revenge or vengeance and just reliving the tragedy that he was responsible for. So I've seen a lot of iterations of that, you know, on death row. And there's days where what I love about Sharon is she doesn't sugarcoat it or make it seem easy. You know, there's days where there's a little bit of that prayer, like, I want to believe, help my unbelief, you know, and I've heard her almost say, I want to forgive and I need the Lord's help right now. You know, this is not a day I'm feeling a lot of love for Dylan Roof, you know. So, you know, and I think that honesty is what we all need to hear, because you can talk about forgiveness in a way that's very sort of sentimentalist and fluffy. And but I, you know, I think of Dostoevsky saying the love that we're talking about, it's not the love of fairy books and story tales, but it's the harsh and dreadful love, you know, that can keep you up at night. And yet love, we know, heals all the wounds of the world. So we continue to pursue that love. Mm-hmm.
A love that honors truth in all of its depth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some of the folks I've taken a lot of cues from are people like Desmond Tutu and others that have lived through tremendous tragedies, even national tragedies like apartheid and the Rwandan genocide, and yet have been a part of healing those wounds. And the beginning of that is always truth telling. It's why it's the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. You know, you can't get to healing and reconciliation without acknowledging the truth. And I think that's one thing that we're still working on in this country. You know, we have a lot of ways that we mythologize and theologize the atrocities of our past and try to justify them and deny them. And as Martin Luther King says, that truth denied becomes like a festering wound. You know, it continues to really infect us and contaminate us if we don't address the truth of our past. And I think we see that in so many aspects of our society right now. The you know, Confederate monuments, of course, and the ways that we memorialize the wrong people, the victimizers rather than the victims. And even the school right here that my wife's been teaching in was formerly known as Sheridan. And Sheridan, unfortunately and tragically, he was famous for saying the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, a school in a very racially mixed neighborhood here is still adorned his name until just recently. And now it's named after, I think the last name is Cesarez, which is folks that went to this school and became a huge advocate in the city of Philadelphia for LGBTQ rights and inclusion. And so that it's going to get a new name. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's, the power of forgiveness. I often think of it and talk about it as, you know, beginning with God. And I think of it as God's givenness, God's way of pouring this overwhelming kind of graciousness, a very truthful, you know, that honors truth in the deepest ways, but that also disarms us. And maybe that kind of process of transformation you're talking about, even locally at a school, is a kind of a disarming of history, a recognition of it and a disarming of it to, you know, open to new life.
Yeah, I went to Eastern University. That's how I got up here to Philly. And one of the other graduates from Eastern is Brian Stevenson, who has started this, you know, incredible endeavor called the Equal Justice Initiative. But one of the things that they're doing is trying to help us do a better job at telling our history so that we can, he always says, we can't get our future right until we get our history right, you know, and so creating memorials to those who were victims of racial terror in the form of lynchings and doing, you know, the hard work of trying to tell the truth of history. And, you know, I've heard Brian say, when you go to Germany, you don't see memorials to the Nazis, you know, but everywhere you look, you see that history remembered of all the lives that were lost and crushed, and the museums, the monuments, the preservation even of the really difficult spaces like the concentration camps, and so that we don't forget, you know. And and yet in our country we've often done quite the opposite. You know, we've even this, I don't know if I'm from Tennessee originally, and in Tennessee we had a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the KKK, one of the most notorious, you know, Confederate generals, and it was there until last year. So that's, you know, you don't remember 9/11 by setting up statues to the hijackers and terrorists. You know, we remember all the lives that were lost. So I think that's a little piece of this, you know, but then there's the personal side too. I mean, we need to tell the truth about ourselves. And I think that's what a lot of people have found difficult with Christians and with the church, is we're often, the folks pointing fingers at other people and not dealing with, as Jesus said, the log in our own eye. And right. So they see these contradictions and hypocrisies. And that's why I love, you know, when my friend Tony Campolo, when someone says to him, the church is full of hypocrites, he's got a great answer. He says, no, it's not. We've always got room for more. Yeah. But, yeah. You know, I think that folks are not, they're not looking for Christians that are perfect. They're looking for Christians that are honest. Right. And unfortunately, that's not something that we're known for, you know. I think that confession is often honored as a sacrament by much of the church, and being able to be truthful about our doubts, our struggles, the places that we've missed the mark are really important.
I know one of the things when I was still in full-time ministry that we were doing at a church up here in Bucks County, I do trauma healing work with veterans in the soul wounds of war. And we gather folks together with civilians and sort of honor our relationship to one another and listen deeply to stories and to hard won wisdom and pain. But we started doing that using circle process more and more in the church.
Yeah.
You know, to pass a talking piece and to listen to one another and to learn deep listening and to encourage, you know, the telling of our stories and the putting together. When you were talking about remembering, I mean, that always just triggers in me, acknowledging that good remembrance is a response to dismembering, which is what happens in so many things in people's lives. So many experiences, even the way that the society lives, that, you know, dismembers the humanity of its people.
And, you know, as I think of that, there's a similar thing that's been happening with us as we transform the guns into garden tools. You know, we've been doing this work for 10 years, but several years into it, rather than just doing it as an exhibit, like as a demonstration, we felt kind of, I would say, moved by the Holy Spirit, you know, that, that we were really kind of spontaneously felt like we wanted to invite people to take the hammer if they wanted to. And the folks that had lost their kids began to beat on that gun. One in particular, Miss Ryan's, as she was beating on it, she said, "This is for my boy." You know, she just pounded on it. And over the years, what that's become is a space to, I think, honor people's trauma and pain and channel it into something constructive, but also to create, I think this is a sacrament. You know, the word sacrament means holy mystery. And I think there's a holy mystery about what we're doing with the gun transformations, but people will begin to share, you know, and we've had folks that have been veterans that have seen their friends take their own lives, or they've seen the horror of combat and war. And so they're bringing that to the forge, and many of them will tell their stories. You know, we had a young man that counted to 18 really loudly, 1, 2, 3. And then afterwards he said that he had taken the life of an 18-year-old. And so that's what he was praying about as he did that. My friend, Reverend Sharon, that I mentioned, you know, she mentioned her mom's name, but then she mentioned all 9 of the Emmanuel 9 that she beat on it. So I think creating those spaces where we can share our stories, but also, even share our anger and our frustrations and our that those are really holy. That's holy work. So it's a different form that it takes for us than your sharing circles, but our sharing circles sitting around the fire of the forge. And, you know, I think it's a very similar vulnerability though. Yeah.
I think of those as forgiving spaces.
Yeah.
Just so that I don't forget, Shane, you and I talked about this some time ago, but I still have a box of hollow point bullets that someone who worked in munitions gave to me. That's not a big box, but I'd love to think of a way and collaborate with you in a way of transforming those bullets into something.
Yeah, cool. Well, we're just getting into the metal casting, which is a little different, but it's a little hotter forge, and it melts that, you know, brass and aluminum too, because parts of the gun are aluminum that you can't blacksmith. So we're learning how to pour them into almost like a syrup, you know, into mold. So we might get into that together, Scott. Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. An old friend of mine, Richard Withers,
Richard Withers.
You know Richard Withers? Yeah. He and I go way back. Richard used to.
I bet my coffee cup here is made by Richard. He's a potter, you know? Yeah, it's great.
A potter and also, well, an artist. He was so many things. A hermit.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
A holy person. Richard used to take items from the trash up at GE Aerospace.
Yeah.
where the nose cones were made for nuclear weapons, and he used to transform them into liturgical pieces.
Yeah. How about
I think
that?
I have some of those around here somewhere, but you know, that transformation gets us thinking, I think, about what God does with us.
Yeah.
In terms of reshaping our lives.
Yeah, sometimes I hold up a shovel made out of a gun and I say, this is what a gun looks like when it gets born again. And, you know, all things can be made new, and so can people, you know. And, you know, even as I think about someone who's done tremendous evil like Dylann Roof, we have to believe that God's love is bigger than Dylann Roof's hatred. Right. And that's why Reverend Sharon and so many of us are against the death penalty, is because in the end, we hold out this belief that no one's beyond redemption and that God's love is bigger than we can ever imagine. And that certainly doesn't mean that, you know, killing a group of people should not have consequences, but to say that the death penalty really just mirrors the evil that we're trying to heal the world of. And you can have truth and you can have accountability and consequences, but still have forgiveness and still have redemption, you know, and the possibility that, as Brian Stevenson says, we're all more than the worst thing we've ever done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, grace and forgiveness can get the last word.
I think forgiveness always interferes with cycles of violence and breaks cycles of violence. I think that's part of the discipline of it. One of the things, and I just want to add this to our discussion, because, you know, you've been sharing a lot of richness. In the Forgiveness Lab, which has existed now, for the better part of 2 decades in different forms, I've always been deeply impacted on this journey by the New Testament language about forgiveness, the noun and particularly the verb forms of forgiveness, because instead of being transactional, the language of the New Testament, is the language of removing obstacles and barriers and lifting burdens and unbinding and liberating us and giving gifts, the giving of gifts to others. So this is how I describe it. I just would like you to respond to it, because this is forgiveness, I think, is a way of being. Forgiveness is the power of God at work in our lives, removing obstacles that have limited love and well-being, lifting burdens that have crushed our spirits and distorted our full humanity, tending carefully wounds of the soul, releasing us from constraints that have stifled reconciliation and the practice of community, liberating us to see and experience ourselves and those around us through the eyes and the heart of God.
Yeah, beautiful.
I think you've been filling some of that in, actually, in our conversation.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well, I like us, Shane, to think about how it is that we live as forgiven people in the world. I mean, we are people forgiven by God, in God's, God acts, unilaterally. And, from the depth of God's being, without any deals made. And God makes possible our responses, which I think, wind up, changing and transforming our lives along the way. So I like to ask people, I'll do it with you, and you've started to answer this, but how do you live as a forgiven person in the world?
Well, when you've experienced grace, hopefully it makes us gracious. And sometimes people ask me how I have tolerance or patience with people who radically disagree with me on things like guns or the death penalty or whatever. And part of what gives me a little grace and patience is I look at who I was 30, 20 years ago And I think if I had met myself, we wouldn't have gotten along very well, or we at least wouldn't have agreed on everything. And there's that scripture that says we're working out our salvation with fear and trembling, you know? And so I think we have to realize that this is not, you know, about a moment, but a movement of the Spirit in us. So I was in Texas and this guy came up to me and he goes, you know, I got to throw it all out there. I'm a redneck. Textbook, you know, gun toting, pickup truck driving, whiskey drinking, like redneck. And he said, but I've read some of your stuff. And he said, it's really messed me up. And he said, I want to ask you if you'd pray with me, because I consider myself a recovering redneck, you know, and we prayed together. And I think like, if we don't have space for folks that are, also a work in progress, just like we are, you know, if we expect everybody to have fully arrived at sainthood or something, or we're in trouble. And even as I look at the dinner table of Jesus, the people he ate with, it was quite a wild crew of different social spaces, of different theologies and politics. I mean, you had a zealot sitting next to a tax collector. You had a, you know, marginalized woman next to a Pharisee. Like these were worlds that never collided. And, mm-hmm. And yet everybody's being made new.
Yeah.
And imagine if letting go of things and they're becoming, you know, taking on the gospel.
Indeed. Imagine if the zealot and the tax collector were one of the teams sent out in twos.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something? Very possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's.
But I also think of that story that Jesus tells of the. He tells it as the tax collector and the Pharisee that go to pray, and the sort of self-righteous religious person sort of parades their own righteousness and says, you know, thank you that I'm not like all of those people. And even like this tax collector, you know, and the tax collector can't even lift his head to heaven, as the scripture says, and just beats his chest and says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And I think of that posture and that story. And it seems really consistent with Jesus's teaching that, Jesus is including, this is a Sister Joan Chittister quote that I love. Jesus is consistently including the excluded and challenging the chosen. So, you know, that self-righteousness, that's what Jesus really calls out, because it seems to be one of the only kind of barriers to hinder the Spirit of God, is this idea that we've got it all together, you know? Right. And I think that's why Jesus calls the religious folks the brood of vipers, not the tax collectors or the, you know, folks right, on right. the fringes of the faith. It's the people, the center of the faith, that their self-righteousness was really toxic. It was yeah. it was hurting them, and it was also destroying other people. And so that's, that kind of contaminant that still exists. I mean, I guess it's, you know, all it's inside all of us if we don't contain it and take care of it. But right. And, you know, working in a lot of justice circles, I see that, you know, I grew up with a form of self-righteousness that was very particular. It was the sort of like, you know, we used to hear, I don't smoke, drink or chew or go out with girls that do. You know, it was that kind of like, uh-huh. I legalistic, conservative version. But there's a progressive version, too, you know, mm-hmm. that often uses some of the same tools to create theological policing and, you know, and moral righteousness that, they're driving an SUV or drinking a Starbucks coffee, you know, or whatever yeah. it is that is our sort of moral litmus test.
It's deathly.
And it looks very different from forgiveness. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to live with integrity, right? I mean, there may be reasons that the tax collector couldn't lift his head, yeah. you know, I mean, but I think that that there is this liberating sense that we're being freed from that. And then we want to try to live, you know, as responsible to what love requires of us as we can, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking back when you were talking about if you would meet your younger self. A thought in the back of my head was, you know, Richard Rohr, where he basically says that in our journey with Jesus and our life with God, everything belongs. Mm. And so everything about us, you know, you and I are talking this morning in this conversation. And the only way that both of us came to this conversation is on the paths that we came. Otherwise, we're in different places. We're talking to different people. We're having different experiences. And so all of it is included. And, you know, that transforming power, when I think about forgiveness, that there, and you talked about it before, that there's nothing beyond God's love or the reach or the claim of God's love. There was he's gone now, but there was a psychologist from Philadelphia, Silvio Fittipaldi, who did some really powerful writing that was kind of buried in journals, but his work was lifted up to me and I read it. He did one journal article where he was looking at Buddhism and Christianity and non-attachment. And I think it was called Zen Mind, Christian Mind, Empty Mind. What was compelling for me when he talked about Jesus was how Jesus didn't allow himself to be limited or defined by place. In other words, place or origin, by social status or social form, and by the limits of the law. Hmm. And somehow, you know, that, you know, what it did was it made him much more available to everyone. So when you hear Jesus's words, which are actually from the lectionary, the Revised Common Lectionary this week, foxes, you know, have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You know, the kind of reframe of that is that Jesus was available to people and could be at home with people anywhere.
Yeah.
And in his life, when I think about him, he's always creating space with other people, sanctuaries for people to be in, even in what seems like foreign territory.
Yeah, it's a good word.
You know?
It's a good word. Yeah, there's a really powerful line I came across kind of randomly from one of the early Christians. And they said, they were kind of building on that idea too. And they said, we have no house, but we have homes everywhere we go. And that sense of community and mm-hmm. also hospitality and dependence on other people's hospitality. But the vision, I think, of what it means to be born again, which gets kind of abused and trivialized and cheapened a little bit, but is that we're born into a family that's bigger than biology. Mm-hmm. And we're born into a new economic structure that's mm-hmm. not just about my personal possessions, but that's about sharing all things in common. Mm-hmm. So that literally, you know, you see it in like Mark's gospel in particular, and when Jesus says, when you leave all these things, you're going to get 100-fold in this mm-hmm. present life. And mm-hmm. so it's this vision of abundance, not just mansions in heaven, but a real resources of abundance of family. Like I'm an only child and only grandchild, you know, Scott. So mm-hmm. when I got born again, I got a bunch of siblings now, you know, but that vision, I think was exactly what the early church had in mind, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. You started, a group of you began The Simple Way really, you know, more than 2 decades ago. And even though, you know, you've created a home there in that neighborhood, you were reclaiming, I mean, with the original house, as I understood it, a abandoned space pretty much in a place that was really on the margins of, the margins of empire, you know, the, you know, even in my beloved Philadelphia, you know, the margins of life. Mm. And yet at the heart of where so many people lived. And so when I think about, you know, that availability and the vulnerability of you guys going there and starting that and learning what being a neighbor could mean. you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's some folks in Philadelphia that have really, you know, sort of stigmatized our neighborhood and, you know, call it the Badlands. That's what it's often referred to as.
Right.
And, I always say you should be really careful if you call a place the Badlands, because that's exactly what they said of Nazareth. You know, nothing good could come from there.
Right.
It's exactly where God shows up and still shows up. In fact, I think God's very comfortable on the margins of empire and the fringes of the power structures. And you think of how Jesus came into the world, and it was actually a repudiation of the messianic expectation that everyone had, that God would come up, but, you know, with this triumph, like kick some butt, you know, take over the world, you know, kind of thing. And yet Jesus is born in the most vulnerable way we can imagine, you know, as a, not just any body, physical body either, but born into a brown skinned Palestinian Jewish refugee body, as Herod is ripping kids from families, you know, the massacre that is happening at the moment Jesus is born, and all the way up to the cross, that vulnerability is on full display. But it's also God's love, you know, and as so many folks have said in different ways, that Jesus is absorbing all the violence of the world and putting it on full display. That's what Colossians says, right, on the cross, and then subverting it with love and with forgiveness in an empty tomb. So we can see, you know, God's love triumph over all the violence and evil that we're capable of. I mean, that's the heart of everything right there. Yeah.
Indeed it is. I know that you and Tony are close, and I heard Tony go on a rip during a sermon years ago about Jesus taking and absorbing the sins, doing exactly what you said. And it was in this big auditorium, and there was just this incredible silence as he, you know, just proclaimed that, and everybody was just sitting with it. Well, you know, I can, remember some years ago, you being involved with some friends in a kind of Wall Street Jubilee. And I wondered if you and I could talk about Jubilee, because that's, you know, all about forgiveness. And, you know, particularly in the Gospel of Luke, I mean, Jesus claims the Jubilee as deeply related to his coming and the inauguration of a new age.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, that Jubilee idea, for folks that aren't familiar, you know, was really God's systemic way of dismantling inequality and power and property, you know. So land was to be redistributed, debts were to be forgiven, set free. Enslaved people were to be freed, the land was to rest, you know. So it was that this beautiful vision of kind of starting anew, right? And there are folks that say the Hebrew people never really celebrated that, but my favorite response to that is, you know, my friend Ched Myers, he says the Christians have never really honored the Sermon on the Mount either, but it was still God's intention, you know.
It's a great response.
This was God's intention. It's really clear. And it's interesting, too, that it's systemic. You know, it wasn't just about individual forgiveness, which is important. Yeah. But this was also about a way to kind of systemically restructure things so that folks were set free from the oppressing slavery and debt that was crushing them, and make so much sense. And you do sort of start to ask, what would our world look like, you know, if we did practice Jubilee? And you, so the story you referred to, that was our attempt to enact it in a very, you know, particular way. But what happened, you know, the backdrop of the Jubilee that we did on Wall Street a bunch of years ago was that we had two different kind of things that happened simultaneously. We got a big donation of money that was invested formerly invested in stocks that was to be redistributed. And then we also were challenging the anti-homeless laws in New York City. And I, along with a bunch of other people, were arrested for sleeping in public. And we challenged those laws and we won in court. And part of that was a settlement that was another $10,000. So, you know, back in when we were like in our 20s, that was a ton of money, $20,000, you know, and still is in a lot of ways. And so we said, you know, this isn't just money we should take for ourselves, even for the, you know, wonderful work we're doing in the neighborhood. We said, let's share this money, especially with those who most need it. And particularly in New York City, where we won this lawsuit, like this money actually belongs to the people who have been criminalized simply for not having a place to sleep. And so we went through New York and we invited folks that were living on the streets and people we met in parks, you know, we said, come to Wall Street. We're going to celebrate the Jubilee. And we're going to also give away, you know, $10,000. And we knew we needed to be creative because we weren't trying to start a riot or something, you know, so we broke all the money, $10,000, up in different amounts, you know, so we got $1,000 in quarters, $1,000 in nickels and dimes. Is $1,000 in nickels, incidentally, Scott, is a lot of nickels, just so you know. And I can remember pulling those. It felt like we were robbing the bank because they're coming out in bricks, you know. And so we're bringing nickels and dimes. And we got $2 bills. You know, we did all kinds of, like, we had a huge group of friends and activists and clergy. And so we gathered on Wall Street. And the night before, we had divvied all that up so that it was dispersed. And people, we had folks that had backpacks full of change. We had folks that were hiding $2 bills, you know, in the parks. And then, you know, we said there's a certain moment where we will announce a vision for Jubilee and for a world where everybody has enough. And we had Gandhi's quote that said, there is enough for everyone's need, but there's not enough for everyone's greed. And we had, as we were, you know, preparing, we said, we need someone that's got a shofar, you know, the old ram's horn that the Israelites and Hebrew folks would use. And Sister Margaret McKenna had a shofar, right? So she brought it. And I've got this wonderful picture of her as we announce the Jubilee and she's blowing the shofar and there's money just pouring down because we had paper, you know, $1 bills that are, you know, the wind's taking them, and these bikers were prepared with their backpacks. They flip them open and, you know, the streets turn silver and there's hundreds of people there that, it, you know, got in the flyer. People came out of Wall Street. This one guy came out and said, my gosh, what we heard the ruckus, you know, and he said, but this is more beautiful, you know, outside and then what's happening inside. He started getting like bagels and giving them out, you know, this one guy I'll never forget was sweeping the street. So he had his dustpan. He flashed it at me and it was full of money. And he said, thanks. It's a good day at work today, you know? And I'll never forget this other guy that he said, I can now get the prescription medication that I need. And he, you know, had a pile of money he picked up. And so all of that was, you know, it was this celebration, but you know, it was out of that we also took the other sum. That was $10,000 of it. We took the other, we created a Jubilee fund, which exists to this day. And we've shared small gifts with hundreds of different organizations that I think are living the vision of Jubilee, of liberating the captives, of setting folks free and working for justice all over the country. So, yeah, man, who knew? what you could do with $20,000 right there.
such an awesome story and an image, which you really, you know, gave some real vision to there.
I don't always tell the end of that story. I don't even know if you know it, but the police told us that we didn't have a permit or something, right? And so like, well, we're, you know, what laws are we breaking there? And they were laughing, you know, and yeah. What, and they said, well, we're going to, you know, they took me into custody. So they technically arrested me and took me in. I said, you know what happened last time I was arrested? We won $10,000. So we're liable to take you to court again, you know, and they, but I have $1 I found in my pocket and I left it in the jail cell. One of the police officers, he said, as I was leaving, he said, next time you do this, just do it outside the police station, you know. But I think of all that, and I think, like, you know, in all the protests that we do, sometimes we don't have that sense of an alternative vision, you know. And I think it's important to call out the things that are wrong, mm-hmm. but I also think it's important to cast a vision for how things mm-hmm. can be made right. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, my friend Brian McLaren, he's the first person I think I heard use this phrase. He said, "You're not just protesting, you're protestifying." And I think that's what it was on Wall Street. What it was, it was protestifying. You know, obviously what's happening here and the unimaginable disparity, you know, that 100 rich people now have the same amount as half the world's population. Like mm-hmm. that's clearly wrong. But like, let's also cast a vision for a more beautiful world. And indeed. So, you know, yeah.
And how do we embody that in very real ways locally? I often think of forgiveness in all of its forms as a range of imagination. And certainly you were engaging imagination deeply, inspired by the scriptures.
It was that. And you know, Walter Brueggemann, who's a dear friend, he uses the word prophetic imagination, you know, mm-hmm. and you know what he says that sometimes we misunderstand the prophets. We think that the biblical prophets were fortune tellers, you know, that they were trying to predict the future. But that's not quite it. And he says they weren't trying to predict the future. They were trying to change the future. Right. And they weren't fortune tellers. They were truth tellers. Mm-hmm. They were trying to wake us up, right? Mm-hmm. And show us that there's another way. Show us that there's another world that's possible than the one that we're living in right now. And even that image, right, of beating swords into plows that inspires our work to turn guns into garden tools, is that proclamation, right? That things mm-hmm. can be different. Like a piece of metal that's crafted to kill can be recrafted mm-hmm. to cultivate life. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, we've got to imagine that a person who is killed can be transformed. Our streets that are so filled with blood, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be this way. And we mm-hmm. can move from death to life. And that's mm-hmm. that's the world that the prophets, you know, invite us into. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's so much we could still talk about, but this has been a generous hour. And so I want to thank you.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
For this time. When you mentioned our friend, Margaret McKenna, I remembered, I don't know, my memory is a gift. It's a peculiar gift because I remember all sorts of things, but I can remember going back many, many years at New Jerusalem talking with Margaret, and she was telling me about you riding your bike over to visit with her. Mm. And I just remember her saying with that look in, you know, Margaret's eyes shine. And she just said, "I really love Shane." Mm. Mm. So, you know, thanks
Maybe
for sharing.
Maybe I need to ride my bike over there today, I think. Yeah.
thanks for sharing so much of, you know, the integrity of your life with me this morning and with us. And I look forward at some point in the future, maybe to be able to talk with you again.
Yeah, great.
And so thank you, and take good care, my friend.
Okay, brother. Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.